Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, all welcome to the show. I haven't cut off my intros. I have my guest on the line. Hello, Congressman.
Yes.
Hi, Congressman Burgess. How are you doing this evening?
I'm well. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well. It's kind of hard to hear you. Is there a way you can get a little bit? I don't know if you have a speaker or what.
How's this? I switched to a headset.
It's definitely a lot better now. Thank you so much once again for coming on. Congressman Michael Burgess from the great state of Texas, a state I probably will be living in sooner or later, as New York taxes keep forcing me out. I want to jump right into it because there's so much that I want to cover.
Yes, sir.
There's so much that you have to offer. I want to also talk about your new book that I think people should go out and read because it's taking the, you're in the trenches, obviously, with the fight with Obamacare. You're also a doctor. Tell us a little more about your book first, and what went into writing this book.
The book is called Doctor in the House, and it is available on Amazon.com. I wrote the book because, well, number one, I did have some policy ideas that I wanted to get out there, and one of the big frustrating things about the last couple of years was people would say, well, Republicans don't have any ideas, and actually nothing could be further from the truth. So the last two chapters in the book deal with, number one, things that your doctor really wants you to know, and then the other part is what are the prescriptions for reform of the system. Now, all of this was, before the institution of Obamacare, but in the last Congress, there were multiple Republican bills out there to deal with problems as they existed in the healthcare system, and none of them, unfortunately, ever saw the light of day. But here's the deal. I mean, right now we're being told that aren't we glad that Obamacare passed because we've got all these insurance reforms out there. Well, look, you could have done pre-existing conditions, and I demonstrate this in the book, you could have fixed the problem with pre-existing conditions, and you didn't have to spend $1 trillion to do it. Are you really okay with kids being able to stay on their mom and dad's insurance to age 25, but having to accept an individual mandate? The problem with all of the insurance reforms with Obamacare are that those are just it's bait and switch. Those are just the lure to get you to bite on the hook. And then once you're on, then you find out that there are all these other dreadful things embedded in the policy, the new taxes, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, the Comparative Effectiveness Board, all of these things that people are going to find they have a great deal of difficulty with. And, again, they sold it to you because they said, well, we're worried about people with pre-existing conditions. Here's the other part to that. We were told there were 12 million people. It turned out there were 12,000 that have signed up now a year after the program was put in place. That's after a year of heavy advertising. In fact, a lot of the expenditures in that have been for advertising, not for benefits for the 12,000 people who've showed up to ask for help.
Yeah, that includes the $3.5 million that Andy Griffith got paid to do the Medicare commercial to, I guess, unscare, if that is, that's even worth unscare senior citizens out of something that they were scheduled to lose.
Right.
Now, to the average American, to the average citizen like me who isn't there, who isn't in the policy discussion, who isn't there during all these debates, we see it as a couple different ways. We see it as a transition of power, first and foremost, because why else would you set up a new, so many new departments, first of so many new agencies to oversee, override, set policy for? And why would you need to set up a whole new type of method to give people medical insurance? You already have Medicaid, you already have Medicare, you can consolidate either the two, or you can consolidate your new ID into the one. Tell us more about, first off, what is this? The initial launch of this of Obamacare, what is it gearing towards? Is it truly gearing towards the poor? Is it geared towards the chronically uninsured, which is really not that much of the population? And the other end of it is, from what I've heard, is that these people are going to have trouble finding coverage anyway for themselves. It's either going to be too costly, or it's just not going to be possible for them to get it anyway. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, and this is one of the big problems here was we're going to cut $500 billion out of Medicare that is, we all know the Medicare demographic is increasing. We all know there's the advancing complexity of what medicine is able to provide and that people are living longer. So we're going to cut from that program and we're going to fund a new entitlement, and this new entitlement is for people to get what are called subsidies in an insurance exchange, and that will cover more people than are covered currently. The problem therein is that you're going to have a tremendous number of people actually drop their employer-sponsored insurance. I'm talking about employers, because they'll find that if the government's giving it away, why continue to pay for it? Yes, there will be some companies that initially try to do the right thing for their employees, but honestly, if their competition is all jumping ship and abandoning this coverage, they will have little choice in order to stay competitive but to do the same thing. And we've seen evidence from this already when some documents were requested from some of the big companies last year when they initially said, well, we're going to have to restate our earnings. Henry Waxman said, well, you've got to give us all your records so we really see what you're doing. And what those records revealed was, number one, they were complying with existing SEC law by restating their earnings. But the other thing it showed us was that these companies are actually doing the arithmetic and saying, I'm spending $11,000 per employee right now for insurance. The fine is $2,000. If I don't, that's quite a swing and quite a differential. I could either pay my employees more, more to the bottom line, whatever the reason. The other thing that you got to bear in mind is that, remember all through the whole debate, the president kept saying and the Democrats kept saying, if you like what you have, you can keep it. And, of course, that was a tip of the hat to how so many people got upset with Hillary Clinton back in the mid-90s when they tried to take over health care. And everyone thought that Hillary was going to take their health care. But the president made a big deal out of saying, if you like what you have, you can keep it. But it didn't really deliver on that. And now, as it turns out, if you like what you have, you can keep it as long as you get a waiver for at least a year. And that is, people asked us when we were doing this, they said, please don't mess up the system that's working for 65% of the country. And did we follow through on that? Of course we didn't. The fact that, what is it now, up to 1,140 different waivers have been applied. Whole states are getting waivers. Whole cities are asking for waivers. It's truly, you can't argue with a straight face that we didn't mess up the system that was already in existence, because companies are clearly having trouble meeting the what they feel are going to be the demands that the Secretary of Health and Human Services is going to put out there.
That's a perfect segue, and thank you for doing my job in that regard and segueing that for me, because I want to talk about the waivers and just the level of corruption. People didn't understand it before. It doesn't matter whether you're liberal, Republican, conservative, libertarian, head in the sand. It doesn't matter who you are, what you are. For you to know that someone else is in your face saying, you have to deal with this, I don't, isn't that the same thing? Isn't that the reason why the unions were formed to begin with, is to fight back against the fat cat bosses that said, created all these rules for their employees, kept them down, kept them grounded, didn't allow them to make money, and they had to abide by all these different things. Meanwhile, the bosses could do whatever they want, smoke cigars, eat cake, whatever, but the employees could not. That's something we really hated in this country. Now all of a sudden it's acceptable, and that's unacceptable to me. The other thing is, as you were just talking about, was that if you like your health care, you can keep it, maybe in the first couple of years, but even he backpedaled on that before it was passed and after it was passed, where we just crossed the one-year mark on that, and that was one of the worst days of my life, seeing that pass, because of the way it was passed.
Right.
What is this waiver system about? Is this going to be literally for everybody, and it's going to be the way to take the teeth out of Obamacare, or is it just for the selected elite that can actually pay off the lobbies to get these waivers, because the state of Maine got their own?
Yes.
So I know the state of Florida is filing for one of theirs, and I wouldn't blame the state of Texas for doing it. Tell us more about that.
Well, and the other thing, of course, the unions that were pressing for this health care law to pass because it was going to remove some of their financial liability, now they're back at the White House asking for a waiver for the implementation. It clearly, the bill was so poorly drafted and poorly crafted, rammed through without a lot of thought as to what it really meant and what was really happening. So it's no great surprise that probably about the middle or end of October, some companies were looking at the new provisions and saying, well, look, we're going to end up having to drop coverage for our low-end employees, our low-dollar employees, because we can't meet the standards that you're going to apply. because you're asking for much more generous coverage than we're providing. So we will just be out of the employee health insurance business because right now we're not required to provide it. And they said, well, wait a minute, we'll give you a waiver. You don't have to comply with the rules and regulations that are set down in law. We'll give you a year's grace on this. The problem is that, number one, there is very little system in place for who gets a waiver and who doesn't. Very few people are denied, but some are, and the reapplication process is not exactly clear or crisp. But here's the other thing. When these waivers all start to expire, what has happened in the interim that is going to make this better? And the answer is nothing. There is no plan B. There's no ongoing reassessment of the problems inherent in the bill signed into law a year ago. So we're going to get to October, and there'll be one of two choices. The waivers will be withdrawn, and people will be required to meet the levels that they were supposed to meet, or the waivers will have to be extended. And, you know, it just begs the question, why was it necessary to pass this thing so darn fast without really understanding what was in it, what it really cost, and what it really did? Why did we have to do that? And, you know, the cost part, you had the chief actuary from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. This thing, remember, passed in March, and in April of last year, the chief actuary came out and said, well, it actually costs considerably more than what we told you to begin with. Well, was Congress asked to vote on a bill with incomplete information, incomplete data as far as the actual cost of it? Did anyone keep that information from us? These are all questions that, you know, last year we could only ask and wonder about. This year we're actually able to get some of the people involved into committees and ask some questions.
Mm-hmm. And I actually watched some of those questions, and you guys were going hard after Donald Berwick, who's the basically running the Medicare and I think the Medicaid services side of it. And he was obviously now infamous, at least on the circles that are actually paying attention, for his statements on, first off, his love affair with the British healthcare system, which they're trying to roll back. So I'm not really sure if he's keeping up with the system that he loves. The other side of it is that he thinks that healthcare is redistributional. And last time I checked, I don't want to give my health to somebody else because they're not taking care of themselves, nor do I want to give the money that I broke my back for, no matter what kind of job I do. I don't care if I'm just playing the stock market all day and just hitting the, you know, clicking the left mouse button. I don't want someone else to be able to take my money, use it for themselves in that kind of capacity, unless, because we are a compassionate nation, they truly cannot afford to do it themselves. Tell us what the alternatives are and what the status is on the Republicans' mission to defund Obamacare.
Well, first off, on, you know, the other thing that people told us during the summer of 2009, we had all these contentious summertime town halls, that they didn't want us to mess up the system that was working. And the other thing they said was, if you do anything at all, can you help us with cost? Because we really are concerned about the way costs are increasing in healthcare. We could have had a hearing with a governor, Governor Mitch Daniels from Indiana, who had at that point introduced his Healthy Indiana program for state employees. And just like everyone else, he saw his health cost increasing for his state employees, and he said, well, let's try something different. He started a voluntary program where the state purchased a high deductible or a catastrophic health plan, coverage plan for state employees. And they said, I know it's got a high deductible. I'm going to fund the money that you would need to pay the deductible into a health savings account for you. If you don't use it at the end of the year, it rolls over, and the next year you start with new state funding. But over time, you can build up a significant amount of money against future health care expenses in this health savings account. Turns out people loved it. The cost for his health care program dropped by 11% over 2 years, and the observation that something magic happens when people spend their own money for health care really got a lot of credence because, look, you have a finite number of dollars to spend on health care. You've got advancing complexity of what's able to be offered. Who should make the decisions about how much care is rendered and to whom and when? Well, what if we left that power in the hands of the patient, in the hands of the individual? And that's exactly what Governor Daniels did with his Healthy Indiana plan. You know, most people understand, at least intuitively, that healthcare expenditures roughly fall into three categories. One is expenditures that are so nominal that you're just going to finance them out of cash flow. Aspirin, Band-Aids, cotton balls, whatever you want. At that level, you're just not going to go to file an insurance claim on those things. You have a mid-range things like braces on the kid's teeth, or having a baby, or arthroscopy of a knee for a torn meniscus. These things are expensive when they confront you, but at the same time, they're manageable. They're not, it's not even as expensive as buying a new car. So it would be possible to save money in a health savings account to use to offset the cost of those expenses. And then finally, there's the never should happen event, the leukemia, the motorcycle accident that lands you in intensive care unit for a week. These things cost a tremendous amount of money, and that's what you need, of course, the high deductible or catastrophic policy for. Well, Governor Mitch Daniels recognized that division of health care costs. He funded the health savings account so his employees could, in fact, afford those things that weren't covered by the high deductible insurance policy. And, yeah, if something bad happened, they had coverage through the high deductible policy offset with the money that they would pay for the deductible. What's the other option here? The other option is an insurance company or the government is going to tell you you've had all the care you're going to get, or get in line because we've only got so much of this to give you because we've put pricing limits on it. So waiting lists and rationing are the other way to hold down costs, but I prefer a way that empowers the individual, empowers the patient to make the right decision for them and their family in conjunction with their doctor. It's a far better approach, and the satisfaction with Governor Daniels' plan is extremely, extremely high, and he's had very few people drop out of the program. And again, it has saved the state a tremendous amount of money with providing, by all measures, excellent health care for state employees. And the sad thing is Governor Daniels was just on the verge of trying to adapt that to his state Medicaid population and trying to get a waiver for that. Then Obamacare comes along, and there's just no way the state is – I'm sorry, HHS is never going to approve of this type of high-deductible plan with a Medicaid waiver. So it was really, there was a lost opportunity. And, our committee could have had Governor Daniels in and said, explain to us how you're doing this. But we didn't want to do that. We called Medicaid experts in and said, how can we make Medicaid be even bigger than it is today? How can we make it, look, what's the amount, the level of fraud that's inherent in Medicare and Medicaid? It's substantial. I mean, depending upon who you read, it's around 10%. It could be higher. It could be a little bit less, but not much. It's always the public programs too that are beset with the fraudulent transfers and the inappropriate reimbursements. You rarely hear about the private insurance companies being ripped off by the con artists. But Medicare and Medicaid, they make themselves easy targets for that.
Right. Now, once again, I'm with Congressman Michael Burgess, a medical doctor, recently released a book, A Doctor in the House. And I encourage people to go read that because he has been front line with this debate, and his input, people like him and the governors and other members of Congress, because there are more than a handful, I think Senator Coburn is one of them, who do have practicing medical experience. This is what they know. They're not just politicians. You guys are not just politicians. You do know what you're talking about, and there are more than a handful of you that the president could have consulted. So that's what really angered me during this whole debate because, I worry about getting things done. I know the whole thing in D.C. is party, party, party. That's fine. But when you're passing something that's going to affect so many millions of people and change the way we interact with our doctors and families and neighbors, for the most part, everybody needs to be consulted, not just a massive overhaul. Mm-hmm.
Weren't we at least obligated to try to get it right? That's what's so frustrating.
That's more than an obligation. That's kind of a mandate, in my opinion. Maybe people see that as the same thing. I see differently. I see an obligation as something that you can kind of weasel your way out of. A mandate is something you're demanded to do, and that's what politicians are sent there for. I would like a few more minutes with you, if possible.
Sure.
Also, after that, I'm going to play a statement from Congressman Rayburn. After he was on my show last week, it was kind of a firestorm with statements that he made about Pell Grants. And how they're becoming the new welfare, and it seems like the big government liberals are always looking for a different way to approach dependency, and this might have been their new way. So he released a statement after that Huffington Post picked up my radio show, so it means I'm doing something right. And that statement's coming, and then interview with Congressman John Fleming to also talk about health care. Now, Congressman Burr just got it. Representative Paul Ryan from Wisconsin, he finally brought out his plan, which is slated to cut $6.2 trillion from the federal debt, right? Not federal deficit, over the next 10 years. Tell us, are you on the side of this, or do you think we could have done a little bit more? Do you think that there's certain things that were left out? Do you think that it's too much too soon? How do you feel about this new proposal?
Well, I think, of course, Representative Ryan makes a very compelling case for the problem that we face in the not-too-distant future because of the spending problem that exists in Washington. And the fact that he's willing to take this on, even recognizing, you may have heard him on some of the Sunday shows, that he recognizes that he's creating a target of opportunity for the Democrats, and yet if we don't do something to stop or reverse course on this spending spree that, is the most predictable natural disaster that has ever faced this country. I mean, you can see it coming. It's in all the graphs. It's on all of the charts. So, no, I think, I know there are people who wanted to see more. I would say from the limited time I've had to look at what he proposed this morning, and he did talk to the conference in general this morning, but the limited time I've had to evaluate it, I would say that he is clearly moving in the right direction. There may be nuances and things that change between now and the time that the budget is actually passed, but no, I think he's on the right track, and it is clear from what you've seen with the discussion of the very small amount of money that we've been pushing around the table on the continuing resolution, that you cannot get to the savings that you need to get with simply cutting discretionary spending. You are going to have to look at the federal budget in its totality, and that does include spending on Medicare and Medicaid, and does include some of the so-called entitlement spending. There's no other way to get to the numbers you're going to have to get.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot of people that go back and forth on the issue of earmarks. I'm one of them. I think earmarks are a cancer because, again, it should be, I believe in federalism, I believe in it fervently, because if a state needs a project, if a county needs a project, locality, whoever it is, if, for example, where I am in New York, Staten Island, there was a massive landfill that closed and then reopened on 9/11 and then closed back again. They're trying to rehabilitate that land, but they're using federal dollars for it. Last time I checked, the federal constitution didn't give them the authorization to take my money and then, or take somebody's money from Iowa and then put it into Staten Island. That's redistribution at its height. So that's the issue of earmarks. But the biggest bulk of the federal budget and the biggest chunk that's eating away at us is entitlement spending. Now, Nancy Pelosi already started with this whole narrative again that, we Republicans want people to die and they want people to get sick and all this, this different set of stuff. Paul Ryan actually welcomed this. He actually wanted this. He was almost inviting it. How is the Republican Party going to respond to all these allegations? Because I think the Republicans kind of want this because some of it is ridiculous. I mean, to think that a representative wants another person to die for any reason is really absurd. So I don't know how many people are really buying this. What is going to be the response or general talking points for the Republican Party now at combating this narrative?
Yeah, I don't know what the talking points are going to be, but I think Representative Ryan explained this well on television on Sunday and then reiterated it this morning in conference, that what he is trying to do is to preserve the social safety net, and that the social safety net is going to shred because of the unsustainable nature of the debt and the deficit, and he's trying to fix that so that we do preserve a social safety net for those people that arguably would need it the most. he does talk about with Medicare beginning a system of what is called premium support, not for people who are in Medicare today. He identified 55 years of age and older who would continue to be able to stay on Medicare and Social Security, but redefining the process for people in those younger demographics who in all likelihood, or at this point, are in danger of contributing to programs that quite literally are not going to be there when they get to a point in their life where they may need help. And he wants to preserve the ability for a program like Medicare to be there to help, more help for people who are of more limited means. He talks about a system of doing this through premium support, not a new concept. In fact, when I was in my medical practice in the 90s, I remember reading about and hearing about the Breaux-Frist Commission, Senator Breaux and Senator Frist, I think Bill Thomas on the House side, was involved in it, and this was a commission set up by President Clinton to save Medicare because he felt that Medicare spending was soon going to be at some point soon going to be unsustainable. So he put together a commission to try to save it. What they came up with was what was called premium support, which is not vouchers, and let me quickly say that, but premium support is much like what federal employees in the federal employee health benefit plan enjoy, where the government, or in this case our employer, makes a contribution for our insurance, and then we are able to pick from a menu of insurance options. And this is what Representative Ryan is talking about for the future for Medicare, to allow people to be able to select from a menu of choices, much the same as the way as a member of Congress or senator or member for the administration or a political appointee in one of the federal agencies might be able to select. This is similar to the way the Part D program was set up. And I know the Medicare Part D program receives a lot of criticism both from the left and the right. But if you were asked to name quickly one federal program that has come in under budget in the last 50 years, Medicare Part D would be the answer. It came in 30 or 40% under budget. And why? Because it was set up on this premium support type model with competition between the insurance companies. I don't know if you recall when the bill was originally passed. First they said that, look, no insurance company is going to show up to try to provide prescription drug benefits for seniors. And then after the fact, we were criticized because, my golly, there's 40 different plans out there. How's anyone ever going to make up their mind? The competition was intense amongst providers wanting to get in and be a part of the system. So Representative Ryan is capturing some of that with the premium support that he is articulating for the future beneficiary of Medicare in the system. But it's important to stress, he grandfathered the grandfathers. That is, people who are already on Medicare and Social Security, 55 years of age and older, those on Medicare and those fixing to go on Medicare in the very near future will not see a change in their benefit. This is one of the criticisms that Mr. Ryan is enduring right now, is that some people who are more conservative say you don't get to a balanced budget fast enough. We want to see it happen in less time. The reason that it doesn't happen in less time is because he does preserve the safety net for those people who have made their plans around this benefit being there. But what he does want to do is give younger individuals, for whom the system may not even exist because of the increases of the deficit debt, but he wants to give them a new set of rules to plan around, and this is one way to do that. And again, I think he's on the right track with this.
Now, the other end of that is why, just to add on to that, is you can't cut too much too soon. I know a lot of people are just saying slice the government in half, slice it by 75%. You really can't do that because, unfortunately, there have been so many businesses or quasi-businesses that have latched onto government funding, that have latched onto government handouts, all the environmental companies, the Go Green companies, or not all of them, but a lot of them, have latched onto these different grants, art companies, all these different entities that have latched onto government programs, and that will cause a lot of people to lose their jobs very quickly, and that's going to basically deter a lot of people from wanting future cuts and wanting stable, substantial cuts. So a lot of people do have to realize that as well. Is this perfect? Absolutely not, but something has to get passed, and when you don't run the executive and both houses of Congress, you can't get anything you want done. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing a lot of deadlock. And I'm not even going to talk about the shutdown motive that the Democrats want to push, because I'm not really too interested in it. I think there's a lot more rhetoric and jargon about it than really needs to be said. If it shuts down, we're not going to crash. We're not going to crumble. That's my two cents on that. Am I correct?
Oh, I think you're right. I mean, those of us who are prudent have been kind of taking our staffs through what the world will look like on Saturday if indeed this happens, because you do need to be prepared. It's, to have the president come up today and lecture me about the fact that I should have been working on this, or that I should be working on this harder. Mr. President, where the heck were you for the last 3 months? I mean, we gave to the Senate a bill that was passed. It was constitutional. It was passed in accordance with the rules of the House of Representatives. And the fact that they never even picked it up and looked at it, and now I'm the one who's supposedly the bad guy in this scenario? I don't think so. The president could have been a leader a month ago and asked Harry Reid in the Senate to at least pick up what the House has done and look at it. Even if your answer is something entirely different, you owe the House an answer. And the fact that they've just sat there with their arms folded and said, not good enough, and we're not going to consider it, and now somehow we, House Republicans, are the bad actors here? I'm sorry, I just don't accept that.
And thank you so much for pointing that out. You've obviously donated so much of your time. I know you guys are very busy, especially with the new budget proposals out. So I do thank you giving my audience a lot of your time. I do want to say one more time, your book, Doctor in the House, is available on Amazon, is available on my site. For people to go and purchase. Once again, Congressman Michael Burgess from the great state of Texas, thank you so much for coming on and basically spouting off about Obamacare, and I hope to have you on and talk about the future of energy, as that is the committee that you are on.
Correct.
And we can talk about other politics of the day. Thank you so
great.
Much.
Great. Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
All right. God bless. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Congressman Michael Burgess. He represents the 24th District of Texas. He sits on the Energy Committee, as I just mentioned, and he will be on hopefully soon to talk about different methods and different alternatives to fossil fuels, or maybe we do need fossil fuels for at least the foreseeable future to get us through the winds of change that we are experiencing and the rising gas prices. There is something that needs to be done. I'm all in favor. I'm the biggest tree hugger you'll ever find, so don't ever tell me that I'm anything but, and I'm just trying to destroy the earth, because I'm more sensible than that. I do think we need to find something else, but we can't deplete our current resources for a dream and a vision that's not quite there and hasn't been laid out clearly. Now, as promised, I want to play the statement from Congressman Reberg regarding Pell Grants and the controversy that's came from that. Hold on.
We're back. This is Voices of Montana. I'm Eric Iverson sitting in for Aaron Flint. We've got Congressman Denny Reberg with us. Denny, we got an email in here wanting you to talk about Pell Grants and that program. You'd earlier referred to the Pell Grant program, saying that it needs reform in the manner that the welfare program was reformed by President Clinton and Republicans in the 90s. You want to talk a little bit about the Pell Grant program and where you see Congress taking that?
The difficulty is Pell Grants are an attempt to do the right thing, and that is to give the low-income student an opportunity to access higher education, and that's a good thing. And in welfare was an attempt to help those most in need. The difficulty is oftentimes a program is so successful that it grows and grows and grows and grows. And what happened was, by expanding the qualification and raising the grant level, last year we spent about $19 billion nationwide on 9 million students. And next year, as a result of all those changes, it will cost $43 billion. billion dollars. It's going from $19 billion to $43 billion. The taxpayer is paying for it. And the difficulty is you do have the ability to go to school for 9 years, and you don't have to necessarily get a degree. You just have to show you're working towards a degree. And, again, the taxpayer is having to pay for that. And the taxpayer is willing to help people go to college, but they don't want, a rapid expansion like that. And there has to be an attempt to try and make sure that the money is going to the people that are most in need and that is affordable. Otherwise, the whole system implodes. And that's what happened with welfare. And I'm not suggesting that college students are welfare recipients. I'm just saying that the program itself is expanding so quickly it's moving beyond the federal government's ability. And just keep in mind, all the other programs out there are affected by the cost. If it's expanding from 19 to 43, that's money we have to pay for, and we're going to have to take it from somewhere else. It might be Title I, it might be Head Start, it might be Early Start, it might be some of the other programs that the listeners want to have funded, because the money has to go into this program. And the other thing to keep in mind is if it goes to $43 billion, the entire rest of the Department of Education's budget at the federal level is only $48 billion. So Pell is almost equal to all the other federal education spending. That's the problem. And so we're going to try and work with the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, on some changes that are necessary to try and bring it back under control. And that's why we made some suggestion of lowering the grant level. Keep in mind that you can get over $11,000 in the Pell Grant right now per year if you're fully qualified. And so we're just going to have to come to some tough decisions, and that is, can we continue to afford and expand and grow Pell to the detriment of all the other programs within the federal government?
Okay. Well, so that was a statement from Congressman Rehberg. Obviously, from I got the clip. It's playing from a local station out there in Montana. But that was there were statements that he made last week on my show Thursday. And there have been a tremendous outpouring of, I guess, support, being that I had nearly 18,000 downloads on that one individual show. People do want to hear what he had to say. It was featured by the Huffington Post, and I got that as a surprise, but that was Friday at about 5 p.m. Huffington Post put that up there, one of their bloggers. And it just exploded from there. It was shared, tweeted, Facebook, all this kind of stuff. So there's a certain hunger out there to hear what he had to say. Obviously, it's controversial, so there's one aspect of it. Then you have the bleeding hearts that say that, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's this and that. He's an expletive, and all these other words that I can't say, obviously. But people need to realize what he meant when he said it. Again, I'm not defending it, supporting it, anything like that. I want you to be able to listen to it and find out what it is. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/everydayradio. And you can hear it. It's a still featured episode right now on the site. It was featured on Block Talk Radio on the front page for a couple days, as was the show that I'm doing right now tonight with Congressman Michael Burgess and Congressman Fleming, who I'm waiting to dial in right now. It needs to be said that no matter what the Republicans do right now, they're going to be demonized, no matter what the Democrats did for a couple of years while they had the supreme majority, or supermajority. I call it the supreme majority because they really did whatever they wanted, except for card check and cap and trade. But the Republicans are being demonized right now for doing something that is a talking point for even the far left, because even Obama is saying that we need to cut, we need to do something with the budget, all these kind of things that he thinks people want to hear. However, he's not really taking leadership on it. As you heard Congressman Burgess say, "Mr. President, where the heck were you?" Responding to statements that Obama made on the budget issues and the budget matters, that where were the Republicans on it? So he and the Republicans need to work harder. So the statement was made just now, and I'm sure that's going to catch a little bit of a buzz, and hopefully it does, so people, again, could hear what is being said and why it's being said and what context is being said, because a lot of things get misconstrued, perverted, and misreported. And just trying to figure out exactly where what Congressman Fleming is. He should be on within a couple of minutes. He should dial in. I don't know if he got held up. Obviously, today was a big day with Congressman Paul Ryan reporting that releasing the new budget and releasing the video, and obviously the social networks were ablaze on that. So the Congressman need to brush up on what are the points of it, how much it cuts, where it cuts, what it cuts, how it cuts, when it cuts, all these different things. So I'm not upset that he hasn't called in just yet. He will be dialing very shortly. And what else I want to... Oh, the government shutdown. The reported government shutdown, whether it happens or not, and by the looks of it, the way the media is framing up, looks like I have him on the line. Hello, Congressman Fleming.
Yes. Hi.
Hi. How you doing this evening, Congressman?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I'm glad to have you on second time within the last couple of weeks. It's a true honor. I just had Congressman Burgess, your housemate, just on the show, and he was talking about Obamacare. So hopefully we can pick back up on that as well, because you just sent out an email blast or an emailer recently about your vision of what healthcare reform is or should be, and then maybe this is the overarching Republican vision. Tell us more about what you feel is the right move for healthcare. I'm sorry, were you about to say something? Or just...
Right. Well, yes, sure. Well, thank you. Congressman Burgess and I both are physicians, and we certainly agree on what it shouldn't be, and it shouldn't be a very steep bureaucratic system where you have a lot of important decisions made by a small number of people about our individual day-to-day lives. And instead, what we would much rather have and certainly function better under is one in which decisions are made by doctors and their patients, where you have many different choices, where you're a consumer, where you can save money and benefit from that, but where you can also have more services, more treatments available if you're willing to pay for those or have plans that do that. And so what that would be what we would call a market-based system, one that's patient-oriented. So hopefully that gives you some broad stroke explanation as to what type of plan, much more traditional in an American way, that we would prefer, and certainly that Obamacare represents, which is much more of a socialist ideal that we see in other countries.
Now, do you see Obamacare moving forward? Because Obama and his administration and his legal team, everybody have basically said, damn the torpedoes are moving forward regardless of what Judge Vincent said in Florida and all the lawsuits and all the appeals that are going on against Obamacare. And with the waivers that just keep floating in, that's also something I just spoke with Congressman Michael Burgess. Where are we at with the waivers right now, and how legal is it?
Well, first of all, a very big part of the financing, and as you know, the financing of this is very questionable. But one big part is to require Americans to purchase insurance, something that most of us feel is unconstitutional. Never before has there ever been a law that required American citizens to purchase a good or service that has to be approved by the federal government. So we feel that the individual mandate is unconstitutional. I think there's as many as 30 states who are in the fight now. As you point out, Judge Vincent declared that part is unconstitutional. But even beyond that, since there is no severability clause in the law, that means that if any part is found to be unconstitutional, all of it is unconstitutional. So the president has been kind of slow walking the lawsuits on that, hoping to get as much implemented as he possibly can, which would be pressure on judges not to uproot and otherwise find Obamacare to be unconstitutional. We, on the other hand, feel solidly that it is not only unconstitutional, but very disruptive. It's going to cause intense financial pressure on states which will have to support Obamacare through increased taxes for the increased Medicaid population that will result. And so that's why states are very much behind lawsuits. So it'll be very interesting to see how this turns out, but I think we have better than a 50% chance of this being found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Do you have your waiver in?
I'm sorry?
I said, do you have your waiver in? Did you submit your waiver over to Catholic?
Oh, no. I think we have, what, over 1,000 waivers? I think he issued just another 168. And what's interesting is that a substantial percentage of that is to unions, and many of those are the same unions and organizations that worked very hard to get Obamacare passed.
I found it very funny, actually. I'm in New York, and we're obviously severely taxed. We're severely burdened with debt and heavily unionized, which is part of the reason for the former. Now, as soon as Obamacare was passed, SEIU basically said to about 30,000 people or so, hey, sorry, we're either going to have to really substantially raise your rates or we're dropping it. And I think the end result was that they dropped tens of thousands of people. Of the people that we would call either chronically uninsured or the people that are less fortunate. So how demonic of them to do this, how draconian of them to do this after supporting this. So we're seeing that this is more of a political move than anything else. With the issue of Obamacare, what is the next step that it has to go through? How many more district court judges or appeals or whatever the legal format is that it has to go through before it reaches its ultimate destination, which is going to be the Supreme Court?
I think the next stop would be the appeals court. And then after that, on to the Supreme Court, although there are moves afoot to have it bypass the appellate court level and go straight to the Supreme Court, because we know it's going to end up there anyway. And once again, the president has resisted that, the administration holder and alike. On the other hand, we who do believe Obamacare to be unconstitutional, we want to get it to the Supreme Court as soon as possible and get that final decision.
Now, with all the back and forth with Obamacare, will the Supreme Court step in before it gets to that level? Because it might take a year or two or whatever, but meanwhile it's being implemented. Can the Supreme Court tell the administration, hey, guys, stop trying to implement it and tell Congress the same thing? Because we are a system of checks and balances, and last time I checked, we were still that. Meanwhile, though, the executive branch is moving forward with the implementation, despite the fact that it's in dispute. Can the Supreme Court stop in before their time or before their ability to make the decision? Can they say, you need to stop this right now before it gets to us?
Well, the answer is yes. Certainly, judges in between, even at the appellate court level, they can always put a stay on implementation. And that would be quite appropriate, because you could see that we could end up spending $100 or $200 billion and then have the whole thing collapse as a result of a court decision, it would only make sense to do that. So, yes, that's quite possible. And I think, though, we have to think in terms of defeating Obamacare really needs to be on multiple fronts. One, as you point out, is the lawsuits. The other, of course, is an outright repeal. And then a third, which we're working hard at, is to defund Obamacare. Obviously, even if it's a law, it's not going in place if there's no money to implement it. And we're going to be making the 2012 elections a referendum on Obamacare when it comes to members of the House, members of the Senate, and, of course, the presidency.
Now, moving off the issue of Obamacare, because that is still a hot-button issue and should still be talked about, that's why I want to have both you, both the two of the doctors that are in Congress to speak about that issue tonight. The other thing I want to speak about, and I just didn't get a chance to speak about with Congressman Burgess, is he's on the Energy Committee. You're on the Natural Resources Committee. There's so much going on with rising fuel costs, and I don't want to demagogue the issue or panda to people that, you know, can't just fill up their fill up a Hummer at will. There are people that really cannot afford to drive their vehicles, and I, for many people, we think it's intentionally done. The reason we feel that way, the people feel that way, is because the Democrats have said it when Bush was in the office. They said that they'd rather see gas at $5, $6, $7 and to the levels that are in Europe. The difference is our dollars, if we put in European dollars, it would make it basically like $10 a gallon instead of the $7 that they're paying in euros. It would just... It would bankrupt this whole country. Tell us, what is the debate right now? Who's politicizing what? How's it being politicized? And is there really any kind of move to actually help the American people? Is there a gas tax holiday? Is there the moratorium being lifted for other people outside of Brazil to drill? What's the situation with that?
Well, you know, this is something that I find interesting. A lot of people seem to believe that when gas prices go up, that's some sort of evil plot by the petroleum companies. And trust me, I'm sure petroleum companies would love to do that if they could. But the reality is that oil products, just like sugar and rice and other things, are commodities, and their prices are direct effect of supply and demand. There's no question that the Obama administration and certainly the left in general, whenever possible, have made drilling for and producing oil and natural gas and other hydrocarbons as difficult as possible. There's been years there's been somewhat of a moratorium on offshore drilling around the country, and then President Bush was beginning to open that up, and then when President Obama came in, he began to try to close that down, but didn't really have a good reason to. And then we had the BP oil spill. No question about it that British Petroleum was responsible for that, but what happened in the aftermath is disgraceful in that our government, despite its own panel of experts, put forth a moratorium and then a slowatorium, which is, that is, slow production of permits, which has happened since then. Our oil production has dropped from a peak of offshore drilling 1.7 million barrels per day down to 1.59 millions of barrels per day. And in the coming year, it'll be down another 250,000 barrels per day. And so the gas prices are going up for a reason, and one of the main ones is just slowed production, which is caused by our government. But at the end of the day, I can tell you, after being in Washington now for 2.5 years and being around the left, it's very clear that it's part of their design to push gas, well, energy prices in general, up. We heard, for instance, Secretary Chu of Energy say that higher gas prices could be a good thing. We heard the president say under his cap-and-trade program that electricity costs would necessarily skyrocket. And if you really listen closely to their rhetoric, what you really hear them say is, we know that alternative forms of energy like wind and solar are not competitive in the marketplace, so we've either got to heavily subsidize them with taxpayer money, or we've got to drive the price of hydrocarbons higher so it will appear to be competitive. So I'm convinced now, after 2.5 years, that that's what I'm witnessing is deliberate attempt by the left and this administration to do just that, do whatever it can to cut off the production of oil and gas and coal and let the costs go up, the prices go up. And what's interesting is that today we know that we have $1.3 trillion of equivalent barrels of oil when you add up all the coal, natural gas, and oil, which is more than any other country in the world, even more than Russia. We really have more reserves of hydrocarbons than any other country in the world, and yet we're still 60% dependent on foreign sources.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for pointing all that out to us, because there is so much that people don't know because of what we're fed by the media or from the media or even just rhetoric from, general statements made by politicians and others and their spokespeople. But hearing it from someone that's, A, from a Gulf state, the state of Louisiana, obviously you're representing the 4th Congressional. Now, you're on the front lines of this battle. Are the Republicans making an attempt to, I know Congressman Nunez, who was a guest on my show a couple of times, put together a piece of legislation on kind of reforming the way that we look at energy and how we handle energy. What is the movement on that plan?
Well, of course, Congressman Nunez is from California, and he has had several proposals. But really, we've had a number of proposals. I have been involved in, for instance, the Natural Gas Act, which would encourage the use of natural gas, which today, if you were to fill your tank with natural gas, if you had a natural gas burning car, it would cost you $1.80 per gallon equivalent. And also, Congressman Doc Hastings, who's chairman of our committee, has three bills that he's launching. I'm a co-sponsor of, that deal with opening more land leasing, that opens up or really makes the permitting process streamlined so the administration can't get by with slow-walking permits. So I'm not particularly familiar with Congressman Nunez's initiatives, but we do have a number of them. And, of course, like many things, you try to get them into the race, and they may get in and they may get voted on, and in some cases they don't. But I know Congressman Nunez, he's a really smart guy, and I'm sure they're very good initiatives.
Yeah, Congressman Nunez, especially from his book, he really got Restoring Our Republic, he really got a feel for how he wants to change the debate in America and how we look at different things like entitlements and similar viewpoints to what you have and a lot of the new Republicans and Republicans that were sitting Congressman Ford this past election have. And now it's starting to come out and it's really starting to bubble up and the cream always rises to the top. And we're seeing the cream rise to the top now as people such as yourself, people such as Congressman Burgess and Congressman Reberg, who's going against the Pell Grant welfare sentiments. And, there's so much more the Republicans have to look forward to, in regard to actually having the backbone now and actually putting forward these pieces of legislation, actually having a voice now in the House, which you didn't have for the past 2 years, actually the past 4 years. Now, once again, with Congressman John Fleming from the great city of Louisiana, thank you for joining us today. I just would like a couple more questions for you if you have some time.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm.
Do you, with Congressman Paul Ryan's budget proposal today, it promises to cut or eliminate $6.2 trillion from the, I believe it's the federal debt. I'm not really sure if it's a debt or a deficit just yet, but is over 10 years. Now, is this going to be a realistic proposal, or is this going to be shaved down? Because, whenever you do something, whenever you bargain, whenever you go into Sleepy's and you try to buy a mattress, you always, the person always says the mattress is $800, you end up buying it for $400. And you negotiate down because everybody has to be happy in the end. Where do you think that this budget proposal leads to, or do you think it just falls flat on its face?
No, I think it's very realistic. I have to say that when I came to Washington, I've been appalled at just how easily money is slipping between the fingers of politicians up here. I thought it was bad, but I really got an education on it when I got up here and saw just how easily politicians and how quickly they'll spend a billion here, a billion there without even a thought. There's a lot of cutting we can do before anybody would even feel it. But basically what his plan, Paul Ryan's plan, is that it would save $6.2 trillion over 10 years over the trajectory that we're under currently under President Obama and his budget submission. With by year 2015, we would be at a balanced budget except for actual pay down of the debt. That is, we would be able to cover our expenses and interest, but we would only then begin to pay down the debt, and the debt itself would be totally paid off in out years. And I forget, it's something like 2025, 2030, something in that range. So this not only bends the cost curve down, but in the out years, it actually pays back the debt, so we're down to zero debt. And believe it or not, it actually cuts taxes. It cuts tax rates from their current levels to 25% for individuals and corporations. But it does close some tax loopholes in getting there. So it really is a combination of increased tax revenues as a result of putting more people to work, a million new jobs, and therefore the more taxpayers you have, the more tax revenue. And it also reforms Medicare by providing something called premium support. So rather than the taxpayers picking up the ever-increasing liability for Medicare cost, what it does is it basically gives Medicare recipients the same sort of program that we in Congress have, which is when we decide on an insurance plan, we go to a website or a book and we look at hundreds of plans, and then we choose the one that we want. We let them all compete with one another, and in this case it would be Medicare, and then you would just decide where your Medicare premium goes, and the plan, whether it's a Cadillac plan or a slimmer plan, and by instilling that competition, you see the prices go down. And we do have history to support this, because Medicare D as in dog, which was passed some, I don't know, 8-10 years ago under the Bush administration, it actually came in 40% under budget, the only government plan ever to actually come under budget. And why? Because it required pharmaceutical companies to compete with one another for the patient's business. It also block grants Medicaid. So basically the government says, this is the amount that your state, Mr. Governor, has to spend on Medicaid. You spend it the best and wisest way you possibly can. And so it begins to take away the liability from the taxpayer, and it begins to put it back onto the users, and also it allows the decisions to be made in a broad and decentralized way where better and wiser judgments, more consumer-savvy decisions can be made. It actually doesn't touch Social Security. At the end of the day, anybody who's 55 or over, that is to say, if you're a senior citizen or soon to be a senior citizen or within 10 years of being a senior citizen, nothing is different. On the other hand, if you're less than 55, well, this saves the program, so you will have something, and it will be good, but it will be a market-based system. Otherwise, you wouldn't have anything at the end of the day, because Medicare and other entitlements would actually fully displace all budgetary spending. We would have no money to spend on anything other than entitlement programs.
Right. Now, the idea of retirement programs has been obviously a third rail. It's also been a very hot topic, talking point for Tea Party members, members of the Tea Party caucus. You are one of them. And it's been something that's been discussed for years and years. George Bush tried to reform Social Security by privatizing it, I guess making it more like the Chilean system. But it's never truly been done. It's always because of demagoguery and pandering, and we saw Nancy Pelosi say today, I mentioned it before in my interview with Congressman Burgess, is that already the talking points are coming out, and Chris Van Hollen, Congressman Van Hollen, is also another one that's just basically fomenting the fears and, you know, governing by fear and ridicule, because they, you know, how they make fun of the Republican proposals. But do the Republicans actually now have, with the more conservative House, I think the most it's been dubbed the most conservative House in history, do you have the political backbone and the stamina to not only debate this, defend this, and pass this should it be, come up for a vote?
First of all, I agree completely with your statement that this is the most conservative House of Representatives, certainly in modern times. And I do believe that the American people are prepared to get a dose of medicine and to hear the truth that they haven't before. On the other hand, I think the fix to these problems is not going to be necessarily painful. They're going to be, again, more market-driven. Again, one example is that we may see, because people are healthier longer in life, incentives for people to say, I think I'm going to continue working because the Social Security I draw in later years is going to be larger if I continue to work. Therefore, you have more people contributing into the system. But I would say at the end of the day, if the conservative Republicans who are finally stepping up to solve problems that no politicians have been willing to solve in decades, if we begin to see an erosion of support for this, I hate to say that you're going to see politicians are going to be just like anybody else. They're going to lose their courage, and they're going to begin going to the dark side on this. Yes, some of us will stay fast, and we'll continue to vote the right way and do the right thing, but the problem is that without support of our constituents and the public in general, we can be replaced and we will be replaced. And what you'll get is the same politicians who've been lying to you for decades who will tell you the sweet nothings that you want to hear and at the same time run this country into bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. Now, last question I want to ask you once again with Congressman Fleming from Louisiana. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. The last question I want to pose to you is, there's been a lot of backlash against the Republican leadership, Speaker Boehner, Eric Cantor, and that's not just coming from the Tea Party and Justin Phillips is from Tea Party Nation. Mark Levin has hammered Eric Cantor, who's a representative from his state, Virginia. He's hammered John Boehner. He's hammered guys like Congressman Michael Grimm because they've turned their back on the people that got them the majority. And you've been on Mark Levin's show a number of times, so you obviously are familiar with his politics and the way he feels about this. Do you feel that there are enough Republicans out there that can safely, as you're doing and you're articulating and defending, that can safely defend this and say, listen, we understand that you like this art center. We understand that you like this gallery. We understand that you like this cowboy poetry festival, as Senator Reid now famously put it, in his defense of earmarks and excessive spending. Are there enough Republicans out there that can safely avoid being defeated by rhetoric, really? I mean, the Democrats just kind of cruise in after they start pandering and saying, hey, listen, Republicans want you to eat dog food, as Sean Hannity says. Is there enough out there to get to the American people in the way of articulation?
You know, I don't honestly know. I can tell you that among Republicans, there are Republicans, we still have a number of Republicans who've been in Washington for quite some time, who really honestly are used to the earmarks and bringing home the bacon and so forth that have worked for them for, in some cases, decades, and would be quite happy return to those ways, who maybe see this as only a temporary departure from that. On the other hand, people like myself, you know, Tea Party group, most of the new freshmen, that way at all. We feel like that's the old way, that way is gone and dead, and we don't want to return to that. But I have to tell you that there are group dynamics in play, and any time you have a group of men and women who are certainly get pressure from different directions to vote in certain ways by their leadership and by their constituents, almost anything can happen. And so that's why I tell people that You know, once you vote the right people into Washington, don't think it ends there. You have a responsibility to remain engaged and continue to lobby your member of Congress, your senator or House of Representatives, to do the right thing and vote the right way, because there are a lot of intense pressures, and particularly on those members who may see politics as a career pathway. See, for me, I entered politics only after practicing medicine for many years and opening my own businesses. I can easily return to those things and be happy. But there are some members, both Republicans and Democrats, that see politics as a career pathway, and obviously their survival instincts come into play. So that's important for every voter to know and understand. And if they want to keep their representative honest and strong, they need to stay engaged with him. Otherwise, just when you think everything is fixed, things can once again go awry.
Wonderful. And Congressman Fleming, thank you once again for coming on and speaking about the budget, Obamacare, and so many other issues. I want to have you on again, of course. It is always a treat to have you. And thank you once again for coming on and giving your time to myself and my audience.
Great. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me this evening.
God bless you. Keep up the fight.
Yes, sir.